Hi, welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use of open education globally.
Learn more about us at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at global level.
We hope to bring you closer to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
And hello, we are recording, and welcome. I am Alan Levine, your host from OE Global. I'm really excited to have a conversation today with Catherine Cronin. We could talk for hours, and also so happy that my colleague Una Daly could join us. How are things with you this morning, Una?
It's rainy here, but otherwise, yeah, I'm so glad to be here. It's always wonderful to spend time with Catherine and you, Alan.
I've known Catherine for a long time, and it's another person where I can't even follow the origin point. I know it's been so many interactions through blogs and social media and meeting in person conferences. And I have to credit when I did a podcast in December with Jonathan Poritz, I started asking our guests to recommend other people who we should invite for a show. And Catherine was the first one on his list. And I was like, well, that's easy. I know her very well. And I've been overdue to talk to her. So first of all, I'm blabbing so much, Catherine. Good morning. And tell us how you're doing today. And tell us where you are right now.
Good afternoon from rainy, windswept Kinvara County, Galway. That's where I am. About 5 miles, about 4 miles from the Flaggy Shore, which you know by my photographs, Alan.
I know. I want to talk about that. Flaggy Shore just contains so many things, but we got to know each other through our work, but also through Instagram, seeing your pictures there. And it's just majestic. So what is it about Flaggy Shore? Let's talk about that. What's the magic there?
I live in, as I said, a small village called Kinvara in County Galway, which is about maybe 20 minutes to drive into the city of Galway, where the university is and where I worked for many years. But Kinvara is really on the border between County Galway and County Clare. And I'm quite near the coast. So if you go out to this area called the Flaggy Shore, the name comes from these big natural flagstones from the Ice Age, when the ice scraped across and created these huge flat flagstones. So everyone calls it the Flaggy Shore. And when you walk along the Flaggy Shore, you're right on Galway. To the north, you have Galway, beautiful Galway in the mountains of Connemara. And to the south, you have Clare and the Burren. So it's just beautiful and wild. And Seamus Heaney wrote one of his most well-known poems, Postscript, about a walk along the Flaggy Shore.
I know you've quoted that poem before. We might ask for a reading, but let's get to talking about you and your work and your influences and what you think is important. But I always like asking, tell us, where'd you spend your childhood years and what were you like as an early student?
Great question. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City, and I went to school in, we'll say, like the late 1960s and the 1970s. It was a time of great social upheaval in the U.S., which you'll know, Alan. And my parents were very politically aware, so as were the teachers in my school. In terms of kind of understanding what was going on in the U.S. in terms of racism, sexism, the Vietnam War, it was something that was talked about at our dinner table and in school and in the playground, literally. So it was a fantastic place to grow up. And our neighbors in the apartment building where I live were from a lot of countries around the world. My father worked in the fire department in New York City. So it was a wonderful place to grow up. And I've made my home in Ireland now. I've lived here half my life. It's home for my children, my grown children. But when I get off the plane and walk down the street in New York City, I always feel like the rhythm of walking down the street in New York City is like the rhythm that's inside me. I don't know if you get that about Baltimore, Alan. It's something really deep and wordless. It's just, I know this.
It is. And I also know it from having spent time in New York, and I did an internship there as an undergrad. And you see it in the movies and the TV shows, but it is so different when you're in the middle of it, that vibrancy. I remember, like, you always get this impression, these stories, that people in New York are mean and rude, and they're so nice.
It's just the opposite.
I know.
We'll talk to you.
It's a secret.
when I was young, I was quite talkative in class and out of class. That's what I remember being young and in school.
Do you remember like teachers that were really influential?
Yeah, different teachers. Mr. Cahill, I remember, who really encouraged me in what I would call now maths or math and gave me a lot of confidence. And a social studies teacher, Mrs. Ross. Yeah, it's amazing how these people just stay in our minds, don't they? Just giving you horizons beyond where you originally needed to stretch beyond where you thought you could go.
See, I just got one of the phrases I want to quote when I write this up. That was brilliant. We'll wind our way, talk about to the work you're doing now, but your interest or entree, what drew you or made you aware of open education or open pedagogy?
It's so interesting that you asked that because it's a question I often ask of people as well. People come from all kinds of different places, don't they? My initial degree was in mechanical engineering, and I migrated from that into IT, the early days of IT, and I was working in the IT industry. Then I had an opportunity to teach in a master's in IT program at the university in Galway in the 1990s, and also with the Open University. When I was working with the Open University and with NUI Galway, I started getting involved in really early days of online education. So I was teaching with the Open University when they brought in the COSI system, which was the first kind of text communication system between students and teachers. And that was in about the mid-1990s. So I progressed along that kind of online digital education in the early days. And then when I realized that I didn't find my way to OER, but I found my way to open tools, where other educators who were teaching online were sharing their stories and ideas with each other. I got it then. And from there, I just followed the threads, connected with people, and found my way to open from that. And once I found open education, clicked with so many things that I had done in my life, community education, women's studies. I had done a master's degree in women's studies because, again, others have noted as well that a lot of the roots of open pedagogy are in feminist pedagogy. So it made sense for me in a lot of ways. And here I am.
That's a rich path of influences. I just noticed that your background in mechanical engineering, some IT. Una spent time working in the IT field. I came from science. I often think about having a grounding in a specific discipline that you really focus intently really help rather than studying like educational technology. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure because maybe it makes sense for us, but thinking of other people who have followed other paths because what you study is only part of who you are and what you bring to your work, isn't it? So like from engineering, even though I haven't practiced as an engineer in a long time, I consider myself a structured problem solver. And I would say to my friends and colleagues, is my engineering slip showing? Because I'll just be really structured about how I approach something and want to get it all organized. But in terms of the worldview of mainstream engineering about having right answers and wrong answers and leaning towards technology as a solution, I wouldn't consider myself a typical engineer and other experiences formed who I am.
I think that background is so valuable, having a science background, because often when you're engaged in conversations, I will say that there's a little bit of one-upmanship in the engineering field. I'm sure I've experienced that certainly as a woman, that it's I have to act differently. And so having the background, having that knowledge brings you into the conversation in a different way than if you didn't have the background. So can feel quite confident when I enter conversations on technology, having that background of over 20 years working in the industry.
I get that completely. I'd agree. Yeah.
It's lovely to hear about the Flaggy Shore. And I don't know if you know this, Alan, but Catherine and I do have roots in common. I didn't grow up in the Bronx. I grew up in San Francisco, but I had relatives in the Bronx who I visited as a child. And my mother is from Galway County. She's not very the other direction from Kinvara, but out of Galway City and grew up on Galway Bay. And yeah, it's a very near and dear place to my heart.
We're having like a Galway Bronx reunion here. So that's part of the beauty too, is finding that there's a have with people. I'm curious too, like I'd like to hear, you did a lot of fantastic work with the National Teaching and Learning Forum in Ireland and made a lot of things work at that level. But is there something, and it's a little bit like, how do you do this? Can you characterize like what like the culture in Ireland or what life there means that influences like this support and interest in open education?
That's an interesting question. I was chatting to the son of a good friend of mine over the holidays. He moved to Japan 3 years ago, and we were talking about the fact that when you move someplace, usually it's within about 6 months or to a year, you can really describe to people like how things are different and what's strange, what's the same, what's different. After a while, when people ask you what it's like, you just say, well, it's just normal. You've adapted to the culture. So in some senses, it's hard for me to answer that question, but I think I can address it. Part of it is the size of Ireland. So like the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning was just a small body, and it worked in collaboration with all of the higher education institutions in Ireland. And when I say all of the higher education institutions in Ireland, that number is in the 30s. Okay, did some work with the Virginia Library Association, and that was about the same size. We were having really interesting discussions. Whereas when you talk about a state like California, it dwarfs the size of Ireland's higher education sector. The other thing is that what we just did about figuring out our connections or whatever, Una will know this is what Irish people do all the time, that you meet and you figure out who you have in common, and invariably you will find something with only about 4+ million people in the country. There are a lot of personal connections in this sector. So even though those higher education institutions that I described are really diverse in ways, in size and focus, some more technological higher education institutions, some are big universities, there's a connectedness and an affinity with all the people that work across the sector, which I think helps.
And it's really not fair to ask you to characterize Ireland. I remember a speaker once who came when I was at Maricopa, and he was talking about his experience as a missionary in like a tiny South Pacific island of 400 people. And he told them they lived in the north. He says he wanted to walk to the south because there's a little general store. And they're like, oh, don't go down there. Those people are very not nice. All cultures have like such diversity and things that we don't know about. So it wasn't really fair to ask.
So true of Ireland as well.
Does that resonate with you, Una?
Oh, yeah, because my father's from a different county from my mother in Ireland. And oh, the culture is so different. I think that's true of all small countries. And
yes. Yeah. Yes.
Get that diversity, even though they're basically cousins twice removed.
Can you tell us a little bit about, I can't ask you to summarize, but what was the work that you did with the Teaching and Learning Forum?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it. I was hired as the digital and open education lead within the forum, but all of the work within the forum was collaborative, both collaborative within the small staff of the forum and with the sector. Almost every project we did, you'd be working together with people from different institutions. But there needed to be a focus for the work when I came in, and we came to call that developing open capabilities. It ended up being really generative concept and kind of pillar around which to organize the work. It draws on the capabilities approach from the area of human development, which is about what a human is able to do and to be. And the key, I think, for me around capabilities is that you don't look at just a person's abilities, but you look at a person's abilities within a bigger context, the kind of social, political, economic, educational context. For the National Forum to state as its overall aim to build and develop open capabilities, recognize that people, students and staff and everyone are coming into the higher education sector with a whole range of different backgrounds and sets of skills and levels of confidence. They're in different kinds of institutions, but we really want to be sure to help each person to develop. So yes, we need to talk about policy and strategy and structures and so on. But if the focus is helping each person to develop their capabilities, then I think that we're winning. And that's winning in the sense of that is what many of us talk about when we talk about critical and social justice approaches to open. To be able to do that kind of within the auspices of a national organization was really exciting. And a lot of people really in different institutions got on board with that and are continuing that work.
Which is inspiring because it moves past, like sometimes we get so focused on the stuff and the resources and the open things.
Yeah, and they're complementary, right? They're totally complementary. I also think it shows that we're always building and developing because I've done presentations and had discussions with UNESCO, and the first OER recommendation is to build capacity. And we took that and riffed on it and just for our context here now and said we thought that building capabilities, again, is a more generative concept and we focus our work on.
Yeah, I love the word capabilities and capacity because it is pretty broad. And so that leaves a lot of room to really push it out and understand what it means.
And that lead to the work then that you did, the more recent project with GoGN, where you work with the communities.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you're always thinking about the individual in their context and what they're able to do in their context, last January, a year ago, I moved from the National Forum to working independently. And I applied for that fellowship with GoGN and knew that I wanted to change my focus. And with my involvement in different community groups and activities, I knew a couple of things. One is that there generally isn't an awareness about open licensing and open education at the community level. And also the work that's happening there is so essential. It's so fundamental. It's completely connected to what the community needs by definition, their community organizations. So that thing that sometimes happens in higher education, or are we talking to the students and are we talking to all kinds of staff? That distance is gone because the community groups are actually people in the communities are doing the work. But they're often working with very few resources and little support. So I sought to engage with community organizations around what I called, the name of the project was Just Knowledge, but it was around the concept of open knowledge. So I just went in and asked, what are you sharing with your community? How are you sharing it? What challenges do you have doing that? And particularly in a post, can we say post-pandemic, particularly in a COVID environment, a whole lot of things had started to be done online that had never been done online in community groups because of COVID. So it was ripe for having those kinds of discussions. So they said, oh, sharing this online, but we don't really know what we're doing, or we're thinking about sharing this online, but we don't really know how to do it. And when someone wants to share something, and that's the milieu in which you talk about open licensing, it's magic. You're not going in talking about open licensing to someone who's maybe not desperately trying to share something at that moment. You're going in and talking to people who really want to connect with their community and find out that this is how people globally are doing it, that it's a UNESCO recommendation that people do it this way. And it was brilliant. Finding the organizations was the hardest part, but the kind of relationships that we built and what happened in the project was, I learned so much. It's fantastic.
Do you want to talk about one specific example of the community organization? Or?
Yeah, I'll mention one comment, which you might like, which is, it was one organization called Green Sod Ireland, which had developed education programs around biodiversity from primary school up to adult education. And they had this one course that they wanted to share. They wanted to put it online. And we started talking about copyright. And they said, yeah, but we know that copyright gets in the way. And so we just call it copyleft. So they thought they had made up that term. It was just so wonderful. So it wasn't even like trying to explain the barriers. They understood the barriers. They knew it, but they just didn't really know how to get past it. So it was a very short conversation about, these are open licenses. This is how different people use them. And they just ran with it. I helped them do one course, and now they are just doing it with others as well. Compared to some of the kind of long-term challenges that you have in institutions where you're trying to change culture and so on, it was really refreshing and really rewarding.
Can you give us a quick rundown of the other organizations that you worked with?
Yeah. The organization that I probably spent the most time with was the Galway Traveler Movement, and that group based in Galway that supports the traveling community. The Galway Traveler Movement itself is comprised of travelers and non-travelers working together to combat racism against travelers and human rights for travelers who are often excluded and marginalized in various ways in society here in Ireland. They had done a project about 3 years ago where they tried to map all of the historical traveler campsites all across County Galway. And it was on a big oilcloth map. And they just had an idea, what about if we did this digitally? So that's what I helped them to do. We created a pilot version of that. And of course, when you do it digitally, then you can add photographs. Some of the people in the Galway Travel Movement recorded stories with older people talking about the histories of different campsites. And this can end up being a really rich resource. And other traveler groups in Ireland are doing something similar. So exciting conversations started to happen about, what if we connect this all across the country? So that's work that's in progress that I just worked with during the year. And then the third group was another group around biodiversity, which is around the declining population of swifts. And again, this group was trying to share information about how people can build nest boxes and conserve swift nesting sites. And they had done work all across Europe and so on. Their work had been translated into other languages, but they never knew about Creative Commons licenses. So now their booklets are all getting CC licenses so that people know that they can use the work wherever they want to use it.
And it sounds like they desperately want their work to be shared. That's the point of what they're doing, right?
That's the starting point. Yeah. I suppose the end point of that project, because it was less than a year, the project, the end point was, I'm talking with the Community Knowledge Initiative at the University in Galway, which is the university-based group that supports community organizations in all kinds of ways, about how can we support more of this kind of work? Because this is just three organizations and there's so much important work going on in communities. So I'd like to see it grow.
When you were first meeting with them, what did you find was the effective route? You hinted at this a little bit, that it wasn't coming in licenses. Can you speak more about what really appealed to the communities, like that didn't make them worried or scared about what, or overwhelmed by what you were proposing?
Yeah, it's such a great question, Alan, because that was the kind of tender point, isn't it? That initial meeting and initial conversations, that not coming in and saying, I can do this. That wasn't what I wanted at all. So one thing that helped was that I was able to say it was a research fellowship for a set period of time. It had the support of GOGN based at the Open University. What we did in those projects would be shared with other researchers, and that ideas from those researchers would come back to the community groups. And that did happen in the mapping project with the Galway Traveler Movement. I shared it at the OER 22 conference, and researchers at OER 22 knew of other Indigenous mapping projects in Australia, Canada, North America. And I brought that information and those examples back to the Galway group. So that kind of materialized right away for them. But the other one, I myself started with the seven principles of data feminism. They do a lot of their work with community groups and social justice work. And really, it's about just listening. What do you do? What are your challenges? What do you need? I have this small, specialized knowledge, but I'm here to learn. And if I can't help you, I might be able to connect you with other people. So it was really that approach was key.
I would guess, though, that like the things that came out of these three groups could be the kind of momentum that spins out for other groups to say, oh, look, we can do this. I'm intrigued as well. I'm just thinking about this idea about things that are place-based, or the idea about maps, because that's where a lot of this work is rooted. I spoke last month to Ewan McAndrew at University of Edinburgh and talking about the Scottish Witch Project, which is just magical, about how that can, it gets people excited about the information there, not the platform or the technology.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Great focus for the work. Different to what we do in higher education.
I wanted to ask you, do you get resistance sometimes when you bring in these conversations about the open licensing and maybe a sense that we don't really need that? We just share this stuff. And why would we be worried about these licenses per se? And I know it's in education.
Yes. Far less resistance than in higher education. Far less resistance. Amazingly. The one thing that helps is I do share the UNESCO approach, just so people realize this is not like an academic thing that universities are doing. This is about the ground level ethos of open education, about equity globally. So that helps. I share the UNESCO call to action during COVID and so on. But secondly, there's a bit of agency there because I prepare a short description of the different licenses and why people might choose different licenses. So that if there's any inkling of, oh, I'm not sure, I'd want someone to use only part of it or whatever, that they can choose a slightly more restrictive license if that's important to them. And so that bit of agency, I think, is really important.
Yeah. And I think when I've encountered, not resistance, but just like wanting to go deeper, they're not just community groups. They're, I hesitate to call them for-profit. Some of them are for-profit businesses. I'm not sure how profitable they are, but they might be doing films or something and that are based around their community. And so there's some concern, I guess, maybe about appropriation from once put it out there, who is going to reuse this, and maybe they're going to use it, maybe not even for commercial purposes, because you can limit that, but may just reuse it in a way that wasn't originally anticipated by the creators.
Yes, 100%. With two biodiversity groups, they immediately chose open licenses. And with the mapping project, the intention was never that the map itself would be openly editable. That wasn't the case. But the discussion about openness and what open means meant that we had really productive conversations about privacy and consent and those kinds of things. It opened the door to a lot of those discussions. And to be honest, the various projects that the Galway Travel Movement had done had hit snags before around things like consent for use of photographs and so on. So we were really clear up front about the practice of how we were gathering information and what would be shared and who it would be shared with.
It takes time.
Yeah, it takes time. And building relationships and building trust.
And that sounds so similar to the folks up in BC campus talk about some of the work they do with their Indigenous communities.
And I learned a lot from them. There was a wonderful webinar last spring about OER and Indigenous communities, and that was really helpful for us.
Yeah.
Oh, I had this question in my mind, and then I just lost it, but now I got it. Now my brain's working.
Okay, Alan.
I was losing track of how many conversations on these podcasts I've had with people who've been part of GoGN, and it's such a marvelous community. Can you give us a little insight, like from being part of that network? What makes it so dynamic, or what has been the value in that network for you?
So many things, but I think perhaps now as open is getting more embedded, things are not the same as they were 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 years ago. But certainly for many people working in open, if you're in a higher education setting, there may be very few other people who are doing the work that you're doing in your institution and really wanting to have those same conversations and not understanding why there are not open policies and so on, and having to really do the very tough work of changing culture. The GoGN network is a network of researchers who are truly global, who you can go immediately, whether they're in online conversations or the annual sort of conferences. It's a community where you can bring the issues that you're having, talk about theory, talk about practice, talk about policy with people who really understand and have sophisticated understanding of open. At whatever stage I got involved, I think I became aware of it even before I went back to do my PhD. But certainly when I was a PhD researcher and in the early days after I finished it, it was so valuable when doing research. But in all the other times when I'm just, I call myself an open practitioner, that community is really valuable.
Yeah. And it has penguins.
It has penguins. And it never lets you forget that we three live in the global north and different countries in the global north, that that's only a very small part of the world. So that's the other thing. It never lets you forget that. And we often try to remind people about the importance of context, but GoGN is the global context. So it's part of every conversation.
I also wanted to ask you about the other big project that you've been working on, is the book Higher Education for Good. Can you tell us about that and where it's sitting right now?
Yes, I took a break to do this podcast from writing and editing, and I'll go back to it.
It's hard work. It's incredible hard work. I've never done it, and I know it's hard work.
It's wonderful. I'll wind back and say that before we started recording here, Alan and I were talking about the OER19 conference in Galway, which unfortunately Alan didn't get to. But Laura Chernowich and I were the co-chairs of that.
I was there.
Una was there. Yes. It was so amazing, Una, being with you in Ireland. And that was just such an incredible experience, organizing it with the ALT team, Marion and co, and then just the experience in Galway of people who were there. So Laura, and we always had this germ of an idea about we'll have to find something else to work on together. We've collaborated and talked, of course, since then. But in mid-2021, we started talking about this idea for a book. And in the year 2022, Laura was on sabbatical, and that was my first year working independently. So the timing was perfect. And we just, through our conversations in that latter half of 2021, we just kept challenging each other. The concept of higher education for good was there right at the very beginning. And we know that we're facing multiple and intersecting crises globally and in higher education. So COVID, climate, austerity, inequality, surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. We wanted to send out a global invitation to invite people to speak to the current crises, but also find some hope. So look to the future, paint possible, hopeful futures, if possible. Because we think, like in looking at other areas in the work in the area of climate, for example, some of, I think, the most powerful work is work that does that. It doesn't just diagnose the issue, but points to ways that we can move forward more positively and more hopefully. So we sent out this invitation last January, 2022, and 100 people sent proposals, wow. Nearly 100. And we said, we invite you to acknowledge despair, but take a critical approach to how we can resist some of these forces that I've just mentioned and find hope and courage in moving forward. So we have, at this stage, we have 27 chapters, 70 authors in 17 countries, I believe. We had an amazing review process that was also global reviewers. Many of those reviews were open. And throughout the course of this year, I've been editing, revising. And what's really exciting is that we don't just have academic chapters. We invited people to write in whatever genre they chose. So there are chapters written in the form of a dialogue. There's poetry, one in the form of haiku. There are theoretical pieces. There's an audio podcast. We also invited artists to contribute artwork. Because I was just writing her OER 23 proposal, because Laura and I hope to share some of this work at OER 23. Angela Davis talks about how we widely acknowledge artists as agents who seed resistance and provide tools for us to imagine otherwise. That kind of came in after a while, about halfway through the project. We said, we need artwork here as well. We are just a few weeks away from submitting the full manuscript now. That's going to the publisher at the start of February, and it'll be published openly this year, probably towards the middle of the year, I'd say.
Where's it going to be published?
I can say that we have been having ongoing conversations with open book publishers who are provisionally willing to publish the book, but that's pending a full review of the full manuscript. With all going well, you know, that will be accepted. So it would be open book publishers. And they've published, if you check the OBP website, they've published a lot of interesting work, also other critical work in higher education.
Catherine, since you've left higher ed, the formal higher ed, been really busy.
Yes, that was the idea.
Do you find yourself busier now than you were then?
I'm not busier, Una. Every bit of the work that I'm doing, I love. So I'm doing some writing, some speaking, some research and this editing. But I feel physically healthier. I am working probably fewer hours. I think it was just any of us who are working within higher education during the time of COVID. And I have so much sympathy for my colleagues who are still working in higher education. It was just impossible to do all that you saw needed to be done. So you tried to do it and wrecked your body and your mind and your spirit, or you had to leave things undone or not help people. And that was debilitating in other ways. I feel like it's just a way of, you know, giving back or contributing in a different way.
And choosing your priorities, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
In the time that you're not doing this work, are your or passions that kind of fuel you, like when you need to get out and do something, or just what motivates you?
First of all, I walk. Living where I live in Ireland is just fantastic because we have some hills, we have the sea, the flaggy shore, and so on. So I spend more time outdoors and probably physically active, which is, I feel much healthier for all that. I also have two adult children, one who lives in London and one who lives in New York City. This for the past year. Just taking, even though they're rare opportunities to spend time with them, either here or where they live, is just a joy. And just being able to construct my life so that can be a priority. I have a super demanding work schedule, so my priorities can be a little clearer. And the yoga and those kinds of things. And reading things other than higher education, books, so novels and poetry and that kind of thing. So really enjoying that.
Now that the book has a time when it's going to be publishers, and what's next on your horizon, do you know?
There will still be a little bit more writing, because what happens when you do these things is you just get more ideas, a few more collaborations in the works in terms of research and writing. And there are some new projects in Ireland in higher education around the area of digital education. And so I've had some conversations with people about consulting on some of those. That's work I'd like to do over the next couple of years, of just collaborating with other people around the whole area of digital and open education, and just bringing in maybe some of these wider perspectives. Yeah, a few things on the burner.
Since I started this thing, Jonathan recommended you. Is there anyone that you think we should talk to, like someone who has a voice that we should bring to the show here?
There are so many amazing people to speak to. One that first comes to mind is, because she's my partner in crime, is Laura Chernowich. I don't know if you've spoken with Laura yet, in terms of work that Laura has done at the University of Cape Town over so many years. Just so important to speak with her. We did this with the book as well, is that our brain goes immediately to the people that we know of. And then because our book was around futures and looking into the future, we have a couple of forewords and a couple of afterwards to the book. Some of those people are experienced, and we ask a new young PhD student to write the final afterword, the last word. And we have other early career graduate students even who are authors in the book. So I think that kind of diversity is really important, because when you talk about the future, their perspective is different.
And I have to admit, like, a little bit selfishly, like, I get more out of these, I think, because I learned so much from talking. I'm gonna go back and edit, and I'm gonna be looking up all the links and projects you recommended. And then, like, when the book comes out, like, I hope we can do something to help tap into the energy that's gonna come out of this fantastic book that's gonna be out this year.
And when you mention book, I think one of the books that has been most influential for me over the time of the pandemic is the book called Begin Again. Do you know of it? It's written by Eddie Glaude. It's about the writings of James Baldwin. And I read it last summer 2021, and has just been part of so many of my conversations and my work since then. He looks at the work of James Baldwin, particularly his later work. And so many people value James Baldwin's earlier work and not his later work. And the later work was written in the time after the civil rights movement had soured in some ways, what he calls the after times. Eddie Claude says we live in another after times now when we're dealing with hopelessness and despair. So he thinks those writings of James Baldwin really speak to us a lot just now. I think the way he describes it, he says, we, just like James Baldwin, we need to stand askance at the way things are in order to imagine better futures. So right. I think that's a great way to think about being an open educator today.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you for this episode of The Galway Connection. And also just thinking, like, we started out with you describing growing up in basically an environment of social justice in the 1960s. It's not new. You've been immersed in that. And I think your parents would be extremely proud of the work that you're doing.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Una, for joining us. And thank you, listeners, to join us for this episode of OEG Voices. We're producing this podcast at Open Education Global. And each time we do one of these, we like to feature a different musical intro track that I choose from the Free Music Archive. I went in there yesterday and I started looking and I found there's a lot of really good music related to walking. I found this really peppy, it's a little bit of a like a South African style music called Soul Walking by an artist named Juanitos. Licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Share. I'll get to hear this when I finally edit this podcast, but that's part of what we do. And so you'll find this episode at voices.oeglobal.org. And we hope you want to follow up with questions with Catherine in our OEG Connect community. And then, as always, anybody else, if you want to be on the show or think someone that we should have on here, we'd love to hear your suggestions. Thank you both, Catherine and Una, for spending this time with us today.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful.